You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions@ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, number 69, How to Break a Bad Habit with Dr. Judd Brewer. If we haven't met, my name is Nancy Montori, and I am the founder of Ordinary Vegan, the website and this podcast. Since 2011, I have made it my mission to help people live a long and healthy life by advocating a plant-based diet. So I am not the new kid on the block. Thanks for all your emails, messages, and kind words. I so appreciate you taking the time to reach out to me or leave a review in iTunes. Your feedback is what makes me want to work harder. Before I talk about our exciting guest for today, I have a big announcement to make. You can now pre-order my very first cookbook called The Easy 5-Ingredient Vegan Cookbook on Amazon. I am so excited. 100 healthy plant-based recipes to help make your life easier. I hope you will pre-order from Amazon because what I am told is the more pre-orders the book receives, the more likely other bookstores will carry it. So please pre-order beginning on Monday, January 27th. You can find the book by searching for Nancy Montori, that's M-O-N-T-U-O-R-I, or Ordinary Vegan, or by the book title. Thank you, guys. Okay, now let's talk about today's guest. Dr. Judd has devoted his career to the mechanisms of habit, and his discoveries have been life-changing for thousands of people. His YouTube video, A Simple Way to Break a Bad Habit, has over 18 million views. He is a psychiatrist, a neuroscientist, a scientific researcher, and an expert on addiction. He is also the founder of Mind Sciences and director of research and innovation at the Brown University Mindfulness Center. Dr. Judd has published numerous articles, and his work has been featured on 60 Minutes, CNN, NPR, and in numerous magazines. He is also an author and wrote a book called The Craving Mind, How We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. I thought Dr. Judd would be the perfect guest for the new year, which I am dedicating not only to health, wellness, plant-based nutrition and recipes, but also to personal growth. I am hoping to bring you more exciting guests like Dr. Judd in 2020 so I can put you in a room with learning experts who can guide us to not only to eat healthier, but also help us to live more mindfully. As author Buddhist monk Pema Chodron says, it isn't the things that happen to us in our lives that cause us to suffer. It's how we relate to the things that happen to us that causes us to suffer. My goal is to provide you with as many tools that I can so you never have to suffer or be scared or feel alone. There are experts out there who can teach us to stay present in the moment and not allow our minds to get sidetracked so we can enjoy life more and no longer be at the mercy of our own habitual thought patterns. Mindfulness and meditation are two of the tools to move us in that direction so we can enjoy life more. As Dr. Judd will discuss, being mindful means being a curious, impartial observer. And this can help you see things more clearly and consciously, which can lead us to more happiness and fulfillment. So with that said, let's hear what our habit expert, Dr. Judd, can teach us today. Hi, Dr. Judd, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your YouTube video, A Simple Way to Break a Bad Habit, has over 18 million views. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And we are so honored to have you here. You have such an interesting background, and you have devoted your career to the mechanisms of habit. But you are also a psychiatrist, an author, a neuroscientist, a scientific researcher, and an expert on addiction. And in addition to that, you also have a strong spiritual side mixed into the hard science side of you. So the first question I have to ask you, can you tell us how you got started and how you became an expert in the field of breaking habits and becoming an addiction psychiatrist also?
I'd be happy to. It was kind of an accidental journey. I never thought I would be a psychiatrist. And I never really expected to be studying meditation and mindfulness, but here I am. My first day of medical school, I remember being pretty stressed out and having trouble sleeping. And I decided, because it was a new beginning to my life, that I would try something new. And I started meditating. And long story short, I was like, oh, this is pretty good. It was helping me be less stressed. I could, you know, I'd meditate during boring medical school lectures. You know, it was really helpful. And by the time I finished my MD-PhD program and was deciding, you know, what field to specialize in medicine, I also realized that the Buddhist psychologists and all the stuff I'd been learning in my own meditation practice was really, really aligned with psychiatry, and in particular addiction psychiatry. So I started, you know, I decided to become a psychiatrist, started training in residence, in my residency training to become a psychiatrist. And I also really, for some reason, I could just really relate to all my patients who are struggling with addictions. I just had a really strong affinity with them. And it's not like I'd had any major, you know, cocaine or alcohol or heroin addiction myself. But what I, you know, 10 years down the road, what I realized was that I had plenty of addictions. they were just more socially acceptable.
Right.
You know, everything from like romantic love to exercise.
Sure.
There was a kinship that I didn't know that I, when looking back, I could really, you know, see more clearly. So that's how I got into meditation, how I, you know, became a psychiatrist, and how I started doing mindfulness research. Because, well, at the time in residency, really weren't that many studies on meditation, on mindfulness. And so even during my residency training, I did my first clinical study and found that, you know, mindfulness training was as good as gold standard at helping people not relapse to alcohol and cocaine use. And then I started doing neuroscience research and neuroimaging and a bunch of other stuff that we can get into. But, you know, hopefully that gives you a little bit of the trajectory of how this came about.
Wow. Well, before we talk about the three steps to breaking a bad habit, I wanted to address everyday addictions. I've heard you speak on that. And many people in our health and wellness community would like to go fully vegan, but they have such a difficult time giving up cheese. And we had Dr. Neil Bernard on the podcast, who wrote an entire book about giving up cheese and cheese addiction. But I would like to get your take on it, since you are an addiction psychiatrist. And is this even an addiction?
It's a great question. And it's funny that you bring him up, because it was he that came through I went to Princeton University as an undergraduate, and he came through the university one evening when I was a sophomore and gave a talk on vegetarianism. And I was so blown away by it that I became a vegetarian based on that talk and reading his first book. So it's funny you bring him up. And it's also interesting that you bring up the cheese addiction, because I just this past summer became basically fully plant-based.
Yay, congratulations.
Thank you. And it was cheese that was my final frontier. So I can also speak to this from personal experience. Now, I know there's a lot on the internet about, you know, whether cheese has chemicals that are addictive and this and this and that. I've looked into it a little bit, but I can't say I'm an expert on the topic. But as a neuroscientist and as an addiction psychiatrist, I haven't found any compelling evidence to say convincingly that cheese, you know, is that opioid-like thing, which I think, and my recollection is a little old because I looked at this a little while ago, but if I remember correctly, that seems to be one of the main arguments, is that it, you know, tickles the opioid receptors or something like that. And speaking personally, as well as, you know, I run a buprenorphine clinic. I work with people with addictions all the time. The way that people describe drug use and recovery from drug use and cravings and things like that is just not, you know, clinically, it just doesn't seem to be the same thing. It's not to say that people can't be addicted to cheese. Hi, my name is Judd. You know, I'm speaking from experience of not, you know, being a vegetarian for like 20 years before giving up cheese. It's not that cheese is easy to give up. I think there are a lot of really great qualities to cheese that can be rewarding. It just may not be some chemical dependence in the same way that we see, you know, opioids and alcohol and cocaine. That being said, you know, there may be somebody that's more of a definitive cheese addiction expert than I. So I'm only speaking from a neuroscience and an addiction psychiatrist in a personal cheese addict perspective.
Well, you know, food is powerful, and it's really connected with memories, I believe. You know, I mean, I often like have this urge for a tuna fish sandwich, which is just so random. But it was something that my grandmother gave me when I was a kid. You know, I would go over there and she'd give me a tuna fish sandwich, and it comforted me, you know?
So
how about food and addiction?
Well, that is much more clearly defined. So I'm glad you bring that up. And the memories are a critical piece to this. So if we talk about, well, let's start with a simple definition of addiction. So I like the definition that I learned in residency, which is continued use despite adverse consequences. It's very simple. It still holds today. You know, this is still, you know, the basic definition. But it also points out how addiction isn't just limited to physical dependence. It can be any behavior that we can get addicted to. Now, if we look at the evolutionary origins of survival, this actually illuminates this whole question around food addiction quite a bit. So to survive, you know, if we were out on the savanna, you know, the proverbial savanna, we had to find food, and then we also had to be able to go back and find it again. We had to remember where it was. So our brains evolved this mechanism called reward-based learning that has three parts. There's a trigger, a behavior, and a reward. And so if the trigger is you're hungry, and the behavior is that you go out and you find some food and you eat it, and the reward is your stomach sends this dopamine signal to your brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. So it's actually set up to help us lay down context-dependent memory, so we can remember the context in which we found the food, so we can go back and find it again. Same mechanism is true for avoiding danger. You know, trigger, you see the saber-toothed tiger, behavior, you run away, and the reward is that you don't get eaten.
Right.
So in modern day, no context is more familiar than our kitchen in terms of, you know, being associated with eating, because that refrigerator is a pretty good source of food, assuming that we go to the grocery store on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
So if you think of it that way, these very, very old evolutionarily conserved mechanisms are still at play in modern life. Yet we start to learn to associate certain things with food that aren't necessarily hunger. So, for example, we go to our grandmother's. It's the trigger. The behavior is we get fed a tuna fish sandwich with lots of love.
Right.
And then the reward is just feeling great, I imagine. Yes. And so every time you do that, it reinforces that behavior. It says, oh, you know, if I see grandma, I might get a tuna fish sandwich and it's going to be good times. So you might get a craving for a tuna fish sandwich that could be triggered by a memory of those good times, or just smelling tuna or seeing tuna or whatever, even if you're not hungry. And that's where the addiction comes in. It continued use despite adverse consequences. We might be triggered to eat food, for example, when we're not hungry, because we learn to associate it with emotions like feeling good or avoiding something. You know, if we're triggered by, I don't know, having to do our taxes, or, you know, our boss yelling at us, and we go and eat a cupcake and feel a little bit better, we might start to learn, you know, every time we have that thought or get yelled at by our boss, that we should go eat cupcakes, even if we're not hungry. And so, you know, and it's no wonder that we have an obesity epidemic in the United States, and that is spreading across the world, because this very, very strong part of our brain, this survival mechanism, is literally killing us.
Well, how about compulsive behaviors? Are they the same as addiction? For example, there was a time in my life when I was young that I compulsively shopped. Sometimes I didn't even remember what I bought. Thank God that didn't last long. But is that considered an addiction? And what can trigger that?
Yeah, many of the same brain pathways are involved with compulsive behavior as addiction. And if your compulsive behavior, and shopping is a great example of this, if you apply the simple definition, continued use despite adverse consequences, if your compulsive shopping had adverse consequences, it would fall into the realm of addiction.
Hmm. Okay. So I take it the breaking a bad habit is how we're going to overcome addiction. Is that correct? Or is it, are there separate steps to overcoming addiction than breaking a bad habit?
I think of addiction and habits along the same spectrum.
Okay.
So on one end of the spectrum, habits can be helpful, right? So our brain actually lays down habits so we can, you know, survive, like remember where food is. But they also lay down habits so we can chunk a bunch of information together and not have to relearn everything every day. So imagine waking up in the morning and having to relearn how to walk and how to put on your clothes and how to tie your shoes and how to eat and how to talk. And, you know, you'd be exhausted by breakfast. So the good news is that our brain has this mechanism to, you know, chunk that information and says, oh, I know how to tie shoes. Don't have to, you know, don't focus on that. Focus on something else. So on that end of the spectrum, habits are really helpful. If you go down the spectrum, you know, moving toward the continued use despite adverse consequences, this is, you know, this is where we run into trouble. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so bring back your question again around that. In terms of breaking bad habits. So one of the primary issues around breaking habits is how we've been approaching this in modern day. And the number one approach, let's use food because we've been talking about that. The number one common way for people to focus on changing food behaviors like dieting is through restriction. So either it's you restrict calories overall, or you restrict fat and low fat diets, or you restrict carbs and low carb diets, or you restrict sugar. And, you know, if you're trying to go sugar free, it's all this restriction stuff. Now, the problem there is that this may rely on the weakest part of our brain, which is called the prefrontal cortex. And that, I say weakest because it's the youngest from an evolutionary perspective, and it's the first that goes offline when we get stressed. And if we've learned
You mean it didn't exist in the human skull at some point and then did exist?
Well, it may not, you might not call the prefrontal cortex a human. You know, it depends on how you define human.
Oh, okay.
But at some point, and I'm not the expert here, but my understanding is at some point as we evolved from, you know, the very primitive brains, and that prefrontal cortex was the last to come online. And it's the part of the brain that's involved in like planning, creativity, you know, self-reference, things like that. Okay. So this planning, let's just use planning. This planning part of the brain is thought to be involved in cognitive control as well, the prefrontal cortex. So if your prefrontal cortex is required for cognitive control, like controlling yourself or willpower, and it's the first that goes offline when we get stressed, especially if we've learned stress eating habits, it's not the go-to in terms of helping, which is – so it's no wonder why diet programs become these – what's called yo-yo dieting. You know, you lose a little bit of weight and then you gain it all back and then you lose some more and then you gain it back and all this. It just goes back and forth. So I just want to highlight that because people think, well, you know, maybe I'm the problem. I just don't have enough willpower. What I would suggest is – you may not be the problem. It just might be a great marketing strategy for some program that says, oh, you failed. It wasn't our program that failed. You should sign up for another year or whatever.
Right.
What I would suggest is that's just, you know, that's how our brain works, is that's the weakest part of the brain. Why don't we actually focus on the stronger part of the brain? And this is where it gets really interesting, because reward-based learning is the strongest known mechanism of learning in all of science. It's, you know, Eric Kandel got the Nobel Prize showing that it's evolutionarily conserved all the way back to the sea slug. So this is, you know, this is good, hard science and a really, really strong part of the brain. So our question was, well, why not harness that? Can we actually use this reward-based learning system to help people unlearn bad habits? And it turns out that this is actually true. We can do that. We've done studies, you know, we've even developed app-based training programs to help people overcome addictive behaviors like smoking. We got this mindfulness training program that we developed, we got a 5 times the better quit rate than gold standard treatment. In an eating program called Eat Right Now, this app-based mindfulness training program, we got a 40% reduction in craving-related eating. And so we can actually see that this is, you know, this is empirically validated stuff. And what it does is it taps into the basic learning mechanisms of how our brains work. So there's one other piece of neuroscience that's helpful here that might explain how this happens. And there's a part of a brain called the orbitofrontal cortex that's kind of involved in determining how rewarding a behavior is. So for example, I'll use a personal example. If I eat milk chocolate or I eat a piece of dark chocolate, my brain compares those two and it says, which one would you rather have? And for me, dark chocolate wins. I don't know. What is it for you?
Dark chocolate for sure.
Yeah. Sure. Dark chocolate. All right. So my brain has this hierarchy set up so that it can make decisions easily. And it says, you know, if I'm presented with dark milk chocolate, I don't have to go and relearn that behavior. It just says dark chocolate, please. And it sounds like you're in the dark chocolate club as well. So Absolutely. Our brains are set up similarly. So that's important to know, because often the reward value of a behavior gets set up very early in life. So let's use your tuna fish example. You know, as a kid, you got tuna fish. And so your brain learns this reward value. Oh, tuna is good. Well, as kids, let's say chocolate cake, you know, think of all the times that we went to birthday parties or had birthday parties where food was paired with friends, presents, and, you know, good times and love. So that reward value gets laid down over and over and over and reinforced to the point where when we are in, you know, midlife and we're trying to resist eating the cake, we're scratching our head wondering why it's so hard to do. Well, it's because our brain says, hey, I got this, kid. You know, this is rewarding. Don't think about this. And so it's really hard to resist those urges to eat cake or eat the second piece of cake. So the important piece here to actually breaking those bad habits is to actually tap into the reward value, which means to help people pay attention to what the reward value is right now so they can update it. Not the reward value that got laid down when they were a kid, but the reward value as it is right now. And I'll give you a concrete example of this. So in our smoking program, the first thing we have people do is smoke. And they think, what? I came here to quit smoking. Why are you telling me to smoke? And we have them pay attention as they smoke. And what they realize is smoking tastes like crap.
Of course.
It doesn't taste very good. And I had a guy who had been smoking for like 40 years. So he had reinforced this process we calculated out, I think it was 293,000 times.
Wow.
So this is a pretty deeply ingrained habit. And when he paid attention when he smoked, he had this crazy look on his face. And he's like, how did I not notice this before? And it's like, well, you learned this when you were 13 and you were trying to be cool and rebel or whatever. And now the reward value is different. You know, it doesn't, you're realizing that it doesn't really taste very good. The reward of being cool was greater than this taste of cigarettes back then. And now, you know, we all distract ourselves instead of paying attention. So as people pay attention, that reward value starts to drop because it doesn't actually taste very good. And we've found that, you know, we can even link that to changes in brain activity that can predict reductions in smoking cessation. So we've got these mechanisms all worked out. If you bring this back to eating, we just finished a study where we basically had people pay attention as they were eating food. So if they had a craving, we'd have them eat, you know, either the amount of food that they were struggling with or the type of food they were struggling with. And after about 10 to 15 times of doing this, literally, it's not a lot, but 10 to 15 times, we could actually watch the reward value of their behavior drop. And it fits into these beautiful mathematical models that predict, you know, that are lined up with brain mechanisms and everything. But the bottom line is, when people pay attention, when they overeat, they realize that it doesn't actually feel as good as when they don't overeat. And so people start to learn, oh, you know, well, let me just eat enough. And I actually feel better. I don't feel bloated and I don't feel whatever. So we even give people this simple mantra, like how little is enough? So they can just really play with what it feels like to explore satiety when previously they'd just been eating and not paying attention to that. And we can even extend this to things like anxiety, which is, you know, where same types of habit loops get reinforced. People, you know, maybe a negative emotion or a thought triggers worry as that mental behavior. So behavior isn't just external, it can also be internal. And then that worry behavior, you know, the reward of that is where people either are avoiding that negative emotion or feeling like they're in control. But when the worry just leads to more worry, it just starts to spiral out of control. So there we can have people pay attention to those habit loops, see that worry isn't getting them anything, so that reward value drops. And then we can have them bring in what I call the BBO, the bigger, better offer. And similar to milk chocolate being not as rewarding as dark chocolate, so dark chocolate for me is the BBO, they can also bring in a substitution. And this isn't substituting one behavior with another, it's substituting it with awareness, and in particular, that attitude of curiosity. So you tell me, what feels better if your brain is deciding what it would rather do? Would you rather be stuck in a craving or would you rather be curious? Which one feels better to you?
Well, curious, of course.
Yes. And of course, because it's kind of a no-brainer, curiosity feels pretty good. So curiosity is really the mainstay of, you know, these app-based mindfulness training programs that we've developed, and really the main attitude of mindfulness practices is to really just get curious about what our experience is, because it feels good.
So is that one of the steps? Like, is that like the first thing you should do is when you have that feeling, that craving, like examine it?
Yes. So let's go through the steps. Step one is that we first have to understand how the heck our mind works. And so what I have people do is map out their habit loops. So let's say it's a eating tuna fish when I'm not hungry habit loop, just hypothetically speaking.
Sure.
So for you, or for some, you know, the example you gave, you would be able to map out, okay, I might have a thought that triggers this urge to eat tuna fish. There's the behavior. And then, you know, whatever the result is, I have a great memory of when I ate tuna fish or whatever. So that's step one, is simply mapping out the habit loops. And we can map out habit loops around eating. We can map them out around anxiety. I even had someone just 2 days ago map out a habit loop around drinking alcohol as a way to kind of numb her feelings of anxiety. So anxiety would trigger an urge to drink, and then she would numb herself out, and then it led to problematic drinking. Even had somebody describe how this habit loop around yelling at her child to go to bed when he was supposed to go to bed. And you know, when she was able to map it out, she was able to then step into the second step. So step one is map it out. Step two is examine the cause and effect relationship between the behavior and the reward. And this is the most critical step, because this is how reward-based learning works. It's based on rewards, not on the behavior itself. If it were based on the behavior, we would just say, stop doing that, and we would stop doing it. You know, stop smoking, stop eating the cake, stop whatever. But of course, that doesn't work. It's really the reward, or how rewarding something is, that drives future behavior. So as I mentioned with the smoking example, if we can see that the behavior is not that rewarding, we become less excited to keep doing the behavior, not out of force or willpower, but simply because our brain's like, meh, not that excited to do that anymore. So using this yelling at our child example that I just brought up, this woman realized, you know, when I yell at my kid, not only does it not get him to bed, and he probably gets riled up, but she also felt guilty. You know, and we've all been in situations like this, whether we have kids or not. You know, when we get frustrated, we might yell at somebody, and then we regret yelling at them because, you know, it doesn't feel good to yell at anybody. So that step two is become disenchanted with the behavior simply by seeing the results of the behavior.
So and seeing, once again, it's about observing that behavior particularly.
Yes, yes. Awareness underlies all three of these. So we have to become aware of the habit loops, step one. We have to become aware of the cause and effect relationship in step two. And then in step three, we can actually substitute awareness, or a kind curiosity, as that bigger, better offer. So going back to the example of the, you know, 3-year-old not going to bed, this woman simply noticed, she got curious about that habit loop, brought in a mindfulness practice to notice those thoughts and those urges to yell at her son. And she stepped out and was able to kind of de-escalate the situation and bring some kindness and natural love to her kid. And surprise, he went to bed. And so I think of step three as bringing in a bigger, better offer, but not one that perpetuates the habit loop, right? So it's not just about finding a better substitution, you know, but it's about finding something that is sustainable. And by sustainable, I mean something that's always available. So awareness is always available. It's not something that we have to go to the grocery store because we're low on. You know, we simply have to remember to be aware. That's different than things like, you know, looking at cute pictures of puppies on YouTube when we're frustrated or something like that, because then we're dependent on the cute pictures of puppies, or any other type of substitute behavior that is external, that depends on something outside of us. Awareness itself is always available. And as you pointed out earlier, curiosity, bringing that curious attitude with awareness, actually feels pretty good in itself.
Okay, you brought up mindfulness, and you have over 20 years of experience with mindfulness training. But the average person, how do they begin mindfulness training? Where do we start? I mean, and what does it really mean?
It's a great question. So I think there are lots of different definitions around mindfulness, and it itself is a concept. You know, if you go back to the ancient language ancient word for mindfulness, it was literally to remember, or remembering. So, you know, that can be challenging. Like, what does that mean? So I think of this really in terms of awareness, right? And so I talked about these three steps of habit change, all requiring awareness. And when you look at mindfulness practice, it's really about bringing awareness to the cause and effect relationship of our behaviors so that we can remember the results. At least that's one way to think about it.
Paying attention.
Yes, paying attention.
Okay.
So we pay attention when we smoke and we realize that smoking doesn't taste that good. And then we naturally start to change the behavior. We pay attention when we yell at somebody and we realize that, you know, it's not that helpful. So we naturally start to change the behavior without forcing ourselves. So that's really what I think of as the crux of mindfulness, is bringing a curious awareness to what we're doing and watching our mind.
That's funny, because the last podcast I was talking about serendipity, and I have a lot of serendipity in my life, and my family's always like, of course that happened to you. And I say, that's because I pay attention. I'm always aware of what's going on around me. I always talk to people, you know, and that's why good things happen, because, you know, you're aware. And, you know, it's so easy just to, you know, not have to think. It is so much easier, or to be caught up in one thought, you know, and just keep going on that one thought all day.
You know? Yes.
And well, it's so scary.
Well, in my clinic, when somebody's caught up on one thought all day, it's usually described as rumination and leads to depression when they're caught up in a thought of the past, yeah. Or it's perseveration when they're caught up in thoughts about the future and they're anxious.
Yeah.
So what's the saying? You must be present to win. Yeah. And that's how I really think of mindfulness, is when we're present, we can actually be with life, even if it's not, you know, not all roses and whatever. We can actually be pretty okay with whatever's happening, because it actually is pretty amazing when you're truly present with whatever's happening, even if it's like a really strong emotion that's,
sure.
You know, that's negative. I wouldn't even, you know, it's like, okay, sadness. Okay, what's it feel like to just totally feel the sadness? Well, it's sadness, and then it goes away. You know? Right. If we don't add anything to it, like, oh no, here's sadness, we can actually let it come, let it go, and be fully present with it without resisting it.
Yeah, Pema Chodron writes a lot of great books about that, you know, just dancing with it and going with it and, you know, like having a whole different experience with your emotions.
And, yes.
That's what I hope everybody takes away from this podcast today. I think that it's really great information. And you know
I'll just add, she is a genius. And one aspect of this is we can bring awareness to what resistance itself feels like. So if we're resisting a craving, or we're resisting an emotion or whatever, we can actually be curious, oh, what does resistance feel like? And drop into our experience and flip it from that unpleasant feeling of resistance, that contraction, to being more open and turning toward it with curiosity.
Maybe even if the, you know, our community who's listening out there can practice that once a day or something, right? I mean, just to get it going in their life. Because if you're someone, you're worried about paying the bills and you're worried about what's going to happen next, or, you know, you listening to the news too much. I mean, you know, maybe you choose one thing every day to pay a lot of attention to. Would that work? I mean, I'm trying to make it easy for people to learn this habit, you know, this new habit.
Yes, absolutely. So the one thing I would say for anybody that wants to play with this is just take an inventory of your day and see which habits are causing you the most havoc, because that is where, you know, that pain point is that actually motivates us to change. I see this a lot in my clinic, you know, where a lot of my patients literally hit rock bottom and then they're ready to change that addiction. So I would say pick a habit that, you know, it's causing some distress. Otherwise, our brain's like, I got other things to worry about.
Right.
But if we can really focus on one there and then just really zoom in and just see if you can map it out and just get really curious, how many times a day does this habit play out? you know, they're already in step one. And then they can just get curious, huh, what do I get from this? I love that simple question. That gets them into step two. What do I get from this? So they can look at the cause and effect relationship. And then as they start to see that that habit's causing them pain, which is the, you know, reason that they'd be interested in changing in the first place, then they can start to get curious about bringing some curiosity right in that moment when they're about to act it out. Huh, what does this craving feel like? What does this urge feel like? And just drop into their experience and even just notice, oh, it's tightness. Oh, it's tension. Oh, it's burning. Oh, it's this thought. Oh, it's this. It's this. And just stay with that urge as it comes and goes. And, you know, like you're saying, pick one, map it out, get to know your mind, and then just walk through those three steps. It's actually relatively simple. Not that it's easy, but it is simple. This you know, this isn't like you have to learn a bunch of rocket science to figure out how your brain works.
Right.
You know, it's a simple process.
Wow, that's so helpful. And Dr. Judd, thank you so much for being here and helping our community with their personal growth. We really do appreciate it. And can you tell the community where they can find you and your book, The Craving Mind, how we all get hooked and how we can break bad habits?
Yes, absolutely. So I have a website that's drjudd.com, drjudd.com, that has a bunch of free resources for folks, you know, want to learn more about how their brains work. Also has information about the apps that we've developed and the research studies that we've done. And I think there's a link to my book there, yeah, called The Craving Mind, where they can just find that on Amazon. And they can also follow me on Twitter at Judd Brewer. At JUDBREWER, and those are two great ways to get a hold of me.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Judd, and maybe we can have another conversation about this in the future too. I really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for today's podcast. Thank you so much for being here. This podcast grows by sharing, so please share. Thank you for your emails, postings, reviews, and your kind words. I couldn't do any of this without you. A special thank you to Dr. Judd Brewer for sharing his wisdom with all of us today. You can find show notes and links to Dr. Judd's book and website in today's show notes. And you can find his book, The Craving Mind, How We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits, on Amazon. Don't forget, The Ordinary Vegan Easy 5-Ingredient Vegan Cookbook is also available on Amazon for pre-orders. And the more pre-orders, the better. I will put a link in the show notes. Please follow me on Instagram at Ordinary Vegan and join our large community on Facebook at facebook.com/ordinaryvegan. As always, thank you for spending your valuable time with me. I am here to serve you and help you live a long and healthy life that is kind to yourself, the environment, and to animals. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.